Lecture 9, Sanctuaries and Sacred Places.
Etruscans, like other cultures, founded sanctuaries to create exclusive and visible architectural settings for formal religious practice. Sanctuaries are the spaces in which temples are built and include not just the temples themselves, but also areas for religious rites, notably sacrifices, offerings, banquets, prayers, oracles, and processional rituals. The placement, orientation, and architectural articulation of sanctuaries are worth examining because all of these have meanings that reflect religious beliefs. No sanctuary is founded or decorated arbitrarily, but purposefully in ways that support these underlying beliefs. In the late 1st century BC, the Roman historian Livy wrote, "The Etruscans as a nation were distinguished above all others by their devotion to religious observances because they excelled in the knowledge and conduct of them." This impetus led to the creation of a number of religious sanctuaries that are in form and decoration particularly Etruscan. We'll examine some of these in this lecture and ask the central questions. What do they represent? And what lessons do they transmit to us about the Etruscans and their culture? The Etruscans spent vast amounts of time, trouble, energy, and money, especially money, in their sanctuaries. Not to be crass or unnecessarily reductive, but let's just look at the money as it's quantifiable. We're fortunate to have hard numbers for one, Pyrgi, a coastal sanctuary of Cerveteri, a major Etruscan city in southern Etruria, about 21 miles north of Rome. The sanctuary at Pyrgi was attacked and looted in 384 BC by Dionysius of Syracuse, an event reported by a number of ancient sources. The Greek author Diodorus Siculus says that the tyrant Dionysius took from the sanctuary at Pyrgi 1,000 talents of treasure and another 500 talents when he sacked additional Etruscan territories. Now, assuming that this refers to the Greek or Attic talent, which was about 26 kilograms or 57 pounds of silver, the theft from the sanctuary was equivalent to approximately $26 million in today's money. And that's just from one regional sanctuary. Now, such tales have always been hard for people to believe. Scholars have argued that the numbers are exaggerated for effect. But there are well-documented cases of ancient and modern sanctuaries with this type of wealth. I'm thinking specifically of the reports that came out of India in 2012 about a Hindu temple. The Indian government required the temple officials to make an inventory of their treasury. And a partial inventory revealed gold, gems, coins, jewelry, and precious objects worth approximately $40 billion. These had been accumulating in that sanctuary for at least 500 years. The point of this brief digression is that sanctuaries are significant markers of Etruscan culture, as demonstrated by the considerable resources the Etruscans poured into them. Now, sanctuaries serve a number of purposes for their founders. They operate as liminal spaces, that is, entrance or exit points, where Etruscan and non-Etruscan people could interact. That fact shaped the form of sanctuaries, which were created for two distinct audiences. They provided spaces for cultural, religious, economic, and diplomatic exchanges. They also reflect changes in the social structure. Many sanctuaries were built in the late 6th century BC, when local Etruscan rulers used these foundations to help break the power of the aristocracies. A superb example is Pyrgi, that coastal sanctuary of Cerveteri. Built on the coast, just south of the harbor, it encompassed several temples, all of which faced the sea, facing those who visited the Etruscans by sea, notably the Phoenicians and Greeks. That the sanctuary was designed for cultural exchange is proven by an absolutely breathtaking find from Pyrgi, a set of three gold plaques found in a votive pit and originally designed to be nailed to the main door of one of the temples. The plaques are inscribed in two languages, Etruscan and Phoenician, and document the establishment of and dedications to the cult of Uni Astarte. As the goddess is referred to by both the Etruscan named Uni and the Phoenician Astarte, this indicates that each of these cultures was a significant audience for this sanctuary. The sanctuary might have also served a diplomatic role. Archaeologists conclude, based on the number of guest quarters, that Phoenicians came to stay here, perhaps while conducting negotiations with their Etruscan allies. The founder of the sanctuary was Thephariae Velianus of Cerveteri. He is thought to have risen to power in the general social and political shift that put an end to aristocratic rule in about 500 BC. Establishing the worship of Uni Astarte at Pyrgi was probably a component of his public works program, as well as a statement of religious support. The overt political use of sanctuaries is not unique to him. Sanctuaries also serve to define individual communities and therefore act as a focus of competition between them. We can see this in the locations of temples on the edge of communities, built to be seen as defining the extent of territorial claims. An Etruscan phrase found in their inscriptions describes such sanctuaries as tular rasnal, that is, the limits of the city-state. As another factor in this competition, we also see a sort of arms race in temple size and decoration. Temples get increasingly larger in some community sanctuaries, particularly those on the edges of Etruscan territory. The sanctuary of Mephitis at Pompeii, built on a terrace overlooking its harbor on the coast, and the Forum Boarium sanctuaries at Rome, overlooking the cattle market and the Tiber harbor, are examples of this sort of placement. The competitive impulse that inspired the creation of sanctuaries on the edges of Etruscan space is also evident in the decoration of these sanctuaries. Sanctuary, especially temple decoration, was used to define communities culturally in a form of inter-community dialogue based on connections to other communities or deliberate contrasts. For example, a number of central Italian temples of the 5th century BC were decorated with terracotta statue groups of Minerva or Athena guiding Hercules to his apotheosis. The wealthy patrons of these buildings used the image as a metaphor for the divine guidance that they claimed. These seem to have been an outlet for wealthy elites of the period to communicate with and make connections to each other. By contrast, the Greek sanctuary of Hera on the banks of the Sele River in southern Italy, just across from Etruscan territory, was decorated with images from Greek myth of individuals and groups who threatened the Greeks and their culture, and who were all killed. Very different message. It seems pretty clear, a message directed at their Etruscan neighbors to the north across the river. The Etruscans created decorations to project similar messages, as we'll get to in a minute. Well, prior to a building boom in the 6th century BC, the decision to found a sanctuary seems to have been based on the presumed sacredness of a particular location. Early Etruscan sanctuaries are found on hilltops and near caves and on the shores of lakes. This prioritizing of physical geography is only one factor in the sanctuaries of about 500 BC, which, rather than being integrated with the landscape, are walled, marking a clear division between sacred and secular. In addition to the boundary wall, all sanctuaries contain a basic architectural assemblage of at least one temple, an outdoor altar, a source of water, and dedications. These serve to spatially and architecturally fix ritual. Note that all major rituals, including all forms of divination, sacrifice, and procession, occurred outdoors. So the critical decoration in each sanctuary was also outdoors. For example, on the exteriors of temples rather than the interiors, so that it was in view of those performing the rituals. A great many sanctuaries had multiple temples, often built side by side facing the same direction. That direction could be based on the need to face those arriving into a specific territory, such as from the sea at Pyrgi and from the river Tiber and the markets along its banks at the Forum Boarium temples in Rome. Inside other cities, temples were lined up facing the city gates, so they were in front of anyone entering the city. Examples include the Temple of Hercule or Hercules at Vulci, the Temple of the Fultha near the northwest gate at Tarquinia, and three sanctuaries placed at three gates at Arezzo. Other orientations were based on more directly religious priorities. The first century BC Roman architect Vitruvius said that temples must look towards the western quarter of the sky so that those who come to the altar to sacrifice may look towards the eastern heaven and the image in the temple. Slightly later in the passage, he says again, "Let the altars look to the east and be always placed lower than the images which shall be in the temple." This injunction of having temples face west was not followed, but the passage from Vitruvius provides critical testimony that the person performing the sacrifice faced the key direction of the patron deity of the temple. Since the three temples in the Etruscan city of Marzabotto faced south, those at the altar in front of the temple faced north, that is, towards the precinct of the sky gods in the Etruscan cosmos. Perhaps the major deity of the city was Tinia, the sky god, or one of his constituents. Now, Etruscan temples shared three major design priorities: centrality, axiality, and frontality. It might be helpful to contrast them with the better known Greek type. Greek temples were generally very large buildings. The 5th century BC Temple of Hera from Paestum is 197 feet in length. Etruscan temples were generally much smaller. For example, the 2nd century BC Temple of Portunus outside Rome is 85 feet 4 inches in length. The Greek temple is raised on a three-step platform, while the Etruscan-styled one has a tall 7.5-foot podium. This difference in height leads directly to the emphasis on frontality in Etruscan temples. The height of the podium changes the relationship of the temple to the viewer, as the Greek temple is accessible from all sides, while the Etruscan one is strictly frontal and forces anyone approaching to do so from one direction. It essentially channels you into a single point of view. By contrast, the Greek temple is peripteral, that is, having a single row of columns on each side, thereby shielding the building within and making the front and rear virtually indistinguishable. Not so Etruscan temples, on which the columns are almost always found only across the front. Probably as a result of their frontality, Etruscan temples were more often found on hills, projecting the religious and cultural identity of a community. Finally, Etruscan temples emphasized their centrality with steps that generally span only a third the width of the podium rather than its entirety, thereby channeling you upon your approach towards the central doorway at the top of the steps. The key to an Etruscan temple was not size, apparently, but proportions. The Roman architect Vitruvius provides us with what he viewed the proper proportions for what he called the Tuscan Temple. And indeed, Pompey the Great built the Temple of Hercules at Rome in Vitruvius's lifetime in the Tuscan style. Well, Vitruvius wrote, "Let the site on which the temple is to be built be 6 parts in length, 5 parts are to be assigned to the breadth. Now the length is to be divided in two. The interior half is to be marked out by the dimensions of the sanctuary, that is the cella. The part on the front is to be left for the portico with its columns." And this is largely what we find in all the extant examples. Almost exactly half of the top of the podium is given over to the front porch and half to the cella, the actual chamber that housed the cult statue. Vitruvius goes further, though, and gives proportions for the characteristic Etruscan tripartite cella. "Further, let the width be divided into 10 parts. Of these, let 3 parts, each on the right and the left, be given to the lesser sanctuaries," the cellas. "The remaining 4 parts are to be given to the central shrine." Now, the tripartite cella has been traced back as far as the 7th century BC phase at Merlo, the site of a monumental Etruscan complex about 12 miles outside of Siena. It could be referred to as the quintessential Etruscan architectural unit for religious and domestic spaces. Quite remarkably, the tripartite cella form was replicated starting in the 7th century BC until at least the 3rd century AD. Excellent examples of this three-cella temple are found at the Belvedere Temple in Orvieto from the 5th century BC. In that example, 2 rows of columns support the roof over the porch that fills the front half of the podium. For about 1,000 years, the Etruscan temple was used widely and developed into one of the most important markers of Roman civilization in areas as far from Etruria as modern-day Egypt and Morocco. Now, temple construction out of perishable materials such as timber had great influence on the building form as well as its decoration. See, perishable materials demand broad roofs to direct water away from timber structures and mud walls. In addition, all of the exposed timber elements were covered with terracotta to preserve them from the weather. That decorative scheme starts at the top with a terracotta tile roofing system. Along the ridge line of the roof, the temple might have life-size or above standing terracotta figures, such as at the Forum Boarium temples at Rome, which I mentioned earlier. The revetment, or edges of the roof, would be covered in terracotta plaques nailed to the timbers beneath. Above the roof edge were antifixes, vertical plaques that covered the ends of the roof timbers and decorated the roof line, sometimes along all 4 sides. In the pediments, the triangular gables on the front and rear of the buildings were large relief or freestanding terracotta sculptures. Even lower wooden elements, such as cella door frames, would be covered with plaques, and sometimes the top of the podium edge would be similarly decorated. The effect of this would be one of an array of brightly painted terracottas in relief or freestanding that covered all of the architecturally significant portions of a temple. We might compare them to the medieval reliquary, a box that contained a relic of a saint. These were lavishly decorated containers encrusted with jewels, gold, and fine, colorful workmanship. Terracotta plaques were the most ubiquitous decorative element. These slabs of carved or molded clay were painted and fired and then nailed to temples. They've been found on virtually every Etruscan temple, where they provided the color and pattern that we believe would have defined the temples to all observers. They also share a number of features unique to the Etruscans. First and foremost, they're non-narrative. By contrast, Greek Doric friezes, that is the triglyph and metope friezes, use rectangular panels for episodic narrative, telling stories with a series of separate episodes. The Parthenon's Ionic frieze, for example, shows a religious procession taking place, and it has a beginning and an end. Etruscan examples, however, have no story, neither a beginning nor end. The Etruscan habit of the non-narrative might best be seen in the 6th century BC phase of the great building at Merlo. Locally produced terracotta relief plaques were nailed to exposed wooden beams along the revetment, protecting the building's timber framing from the elements. The four categories of images on these plaques, representing a horse race, a banquet, a procession, and an assembly, reveal much about Etruscan culture and central Italian sacred art in the 6th century BC. Three of these subjects, the horse race, banquet, and procession, have earlier parallels in Greek and Near Eastern art. Most scholars interpret these as generic, idealized images of elite ceremonial experiences, rather than as scenes that might narrate Greek or Etruscan myths or local history or legend. The procession plaque at Merlo has two people, a man and a woman, seated and riding in a cart pulled by two horses. Above their heads is a large parasol. The woman wears a cloak that's pulled over her head, not just her shoulders. In front of the team of horses, two female figures walk, carrying small sticks and holding the leads on the horses. Behind the cart walk two smaller female figures. Each carries a fan in her right hand and a vessel by a handle in her left. Each also carries something on her head. One has a box or container on her head, and the other balances an upside-down footstool on her head. These are clearly the attendants of the seated figures in the horse-drawn cart. Now, in ancient art, being seated indicates high status, while standing indicates a servant. I love the procession plaques from Merlo. They are the perfect example of generic representation. They could be almost anyone, anywhere, at any time. Gods? Maybe. Etruscan elites? Possibly. Wealthy merchants? Who could say not? And what's going on here? Is this a funeral? Triumphal procession? Religious procession? A marriage scene of the couple leaving for their home? A historical event, such as the immigration of Tarquinius Priscus and Tanaquil? Maybe. It could be any or all of these. The procession is a ubiquitous image in Etruscan art because it was an important event in high-status life. Processions marked all of the crucial life events and transitional experiences for an elite Etruscan, as they did for the gods as well. We think the identities are deliberately blurred here to keep this generic and vaguely meaningful to any viewer. Now, the so-called assembly relief, which does not portray an event in high-status Etruscan life, depicts eight figures, five seated and three others standing. Posture and hierarchy of scale indicate the elite status of the seated figures, while the smaller scale standing figures interspersed between them are clearly servants. One woman holds a fan and vessel, just like the female servants on the procession relief. Of the seated figures, four are male, on folding chairs with footstools. The fifth, a woman, is seated on a more elaborate chair with a rounded back and base of the type typically found in Etruscan tombs to signify elites. Her appearance reflects the high status of women in Etruscan culture. Each seated figure possesses a different attribute, revealing that this is an assembly of the gods. Two of them on the right, distinguished by more elaborate footstools than the three others, may be the sky god Tinia and his consort Uni, the principal god and goddess of the Etruscans. The male deity with an axe is perhaps Cephalens, the Etruscan version of Vulcan. In contrast to Greek practice, clearly no story is taking place here. It's a purely generic scene of enthroned divine figures, perhaps to reinforce the sanctity of the structure. The temple of Apollo, or Apollo, at Veii, a southern Etruscan city 10 miles north of Rome, demonstrates the Etruscan adaptation of Greek archaic sculpture. It's decorated with at least four over-life-size statues of deities, Termes, Hercle, Apollo, and Letua, that stand on the ridgeline of the temple. Unlike a contemporary Greek figure, which would be nude, the Apollo, or Greek Apollo, is dressed in a tunic and cloak. His figure is covered with a great deal of decorative design, including the precise folds of his garments, as well as muscles and the shin bones of his lower legs, his facial features, and his hair sculpted in long, elaborate locks. Even the support between his legs is finished with an Ionic volute design, the spiral found on Greek column capitals in Ionia. The figure was certainly created by an Etruscan sculptor, inspired by the works found in Greek communities in Ionia, that is what is today Western Turkey, showing, I think, the international nature of the art in this period. The figure is more dynamic than surviving contemporary Greek works due to the Etruscan style and the use of terracotta. The sculptor of this group is believed to have been Volca of Veii, the only Etruscan artist whose name is known. He's also credited with the contemporary statues at the temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus on the Capitoline Hill in Rome from 509 BC. The temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus provides our best surviving example of the full range of temple decoration, thanks to its image in ancient art and the testimony of ancient authors. Begun by the final Etruscan king of Rome, the temple faced south, meaning that those who stood in front of the altar looked to the north, the precinct of the sky god Tinia, the Etruscan version of Jupiter. In addition to its appearance in art, the temple is frequently mentioned in ancient literary sources, and those descriptions are useful in understanding the temple and the full range of decorative and subsidiary materials that would fill an Etruscan sanctuary. The terracotta statue of Jupiter in the temple was clothed with a tunic adorned with palm branches and victories, and a purple toga embroidered with gold, a ritual costume introduced from northern Etruria, where it was worn by high magistrates on special occasions. The superstructure of the temple was of wood, and on the apex of the pediment was a terracotta group, Jupiter in a four-horse chariot by Volca of Veii. The pediment and roof were decorated with painted terracotta figures, among them a statue of Summanus, the god of thunder, on the peak of the roof. The statue was damaged by a thunderbolt in 275 BC, a pretty significant omen. In 193 BC, the temple was decorated with a display of gilt shields, another notably Etruscan form of display seen earlier in their tombs. As for temple gifts and embellishments, these reveal the role of piety and personal aggrandizement in the dedications that created the decorative display in a sanctuary. When gathered together, they also give a sense of the information that can be collected from a large number of ancient authors to supplement our understanding of the role of piety in changing the space and decor of a sanctuary. Sometime early in the 2nd century BC, a mosaic pavement was laid in the cella of the temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus, and in 142 BC, the ceiling was gilded. The temple became a repository of works of art of many sorts. For example, Pliny the Elder records some of the paintings. Nicomachus painted the Rape of Persephone, which hung in the cella of Minerva on the Capitoline, he says. More common were dedicatory offerings and victory trophies from Roman generals and others, of which the earliest recorded was a golden crown presented by the Latins in 459 BC. Some of the offerings were of particular significance. Pliny writes that Marcius found the Carthaginian general Hasdrubal's shield when he captured his camp in 207 BC. This shield hung above the doors of the Capitoline Temple. The number of these dedications became so great that in 179 BC, it was necessary to remove some of the statues and many of the shields affixed to the columns. Since these were now sacred materials, they were the property of the sanctuary and couldn't be removed or destroyed, but had to be stored on site. This generally meant burial. As a consequence, much of the material found in sanctuaries has been discovered in so-called votive pits. These pits could include pottery, inscriptions, statuettes, and souvenirs from various military victories, even large-scale sculpture. It represents tangible evidence of ritual activity based on impulses of piety and display. It might also help to explain the immense value of material that accumulated in these spaces, making them attractive targets for looting. I believe, and hope you'll agree, that Etruscan sanctuaries open a door into ancient history that allows us to see glimpses of Etruscan world structure, belief systems, religious priorities, and ritual requirements. From their layout to their decoration, they reveal the twin tendencies towards piety and display found throughout Etruscan life.